This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Well, Margaret, we're celebrating a 50th anniversary this year.
That's right, Mark. It has been 50 years since the Surgeon General's first report on the harm of cigarette smoking and its direct link to lung cancer was revealed.
Well, the Surgeon General's report back in 1964 ultimately led to a sharp drop in the number of people smoking. It's still the leading cause of preventable deaths in this country. Just under 500,000 people a year die from smoking-related illnesses.
And it is interesting to note, Mark, that the numbers have declined more in recent years thanks to the smoking bans now in place in most public spaces. You know, these public health policies and social marketing impact really has an impact on the health and well-being of a population. New York City just celebrated 10 years of a public smoking ban and noted that an estimated 10,000 lives have been saved in that city alone as a result.
New York City has certainly been a trailblazer, as well as other states across the country who've increased the taxes on cigarette smoking. I think that may be one of the reasons there's been a dramatic decline in the recent years in the number of young to middle-aged adults being diagnosed with lung cancer. As well as the bans on smoking, these are certainly preventative interventions at work.
And we need all the good work we can get because we still have opposition. Hard to believe, but the tobacco industry is still working on its business, which is a profit business. A recent study showed that cigarettes being manufactured today are actually made with more addictive levels of nicotine in them than in years past. As the Institute of Medicine's Dr. Harvey Feinberg recently told us, greed is definitely one of the seven deadly sins when it comes to negative impacts on health.
That it is indeed, Margaret. And also, we're commemorating another anniversary, as we do this time in January every year. That is the life and work of Dr. Martin Luther King, who once said that of all the forms of inequality, injustice in healthcare is the most shocking and inhumane. And those words, unfortunately, still ring true today.
And that is something that our guest today is quite expert with. Dr. Beverly Malone is on the advisory board of the Office of Minority Health at the Department of Health and Human Services, and she'll talk about their goal of ending ethnic and racial health disparities in this country.
She's also the CEO of the National League for Nursing. She will talk about the changing landscape in the nursing profession, how educational adjustments need to be facilitated by enhancing nurses' education in this country to meet the growing demands.
Lori Robertson, the managing editor of FactCheck.org, looks into misstatements spoken about health policy in the public domain.
But no matter what the topic, you can hear all of our shows by going to CHC Radio. And as always, if you have comments, please email us at chcradio.com. Find us on Facebook or Twitter because we'd love hearing from you.
And we'll get to our interview with Dr. Beverly Malone in just a moment.
But first, here's our producer, Marianne O'Hare, with this week's headline news.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines. 2014 and earnings potential. Hospital groups are cautiously optimistic. At the recent J.P. Morgan Healthcare Conference, representatives from a number of hospital organizations were looking at continued trends from recent years. Inpatient volume down, but outpatient visits are up. And while cost-cutting measures are more in place, there are signs the outpatient volume will continue. Ambulatory facilities growth is in the forecast for many parts of the country in the coming year and beyond. The trend means more jobs for physicians and other practitioners to fill those spaces to meet the growing demand. Many executives polled viewed the health reform measures in place as a net positive for business, even in states yet to expand Medicaid. Now to the Medicaid expansion. While businesses on the insurance exchanges languished in the early days, business has been brisk in those states that expanded Medicaid to a broader swath of their low-income populations. Recent analysis of the millions of additional Americans qualifying for Medicaid expansion had been previously uninsured and often denied care or avoided care they knew they couldn't afford, whereas the bulk of the 2 million plus who've signed up for the insurance coverage on the exchanges had some kind of coverage before signing up on those exchanges. And what of all those canceled policies that didn't meet minimum requirements for the Affordable Care Act? Well, a RAND Corporation study looked at those folks being allowed to keep their substandard plans and said it won't have a significant impact on the overall sign-up numbers under the Affordable Care Act. Once those customers compared what they had to what they might find on the exchanges, many opted for more comprehensive exchange plans that offered more coverage and also a tax subsidy on the back end in many cases. and concussions and kids. A recent study showed there should be concern beyond the gridiron of the peewee football circles. Study showed some 56 out of 350 girls in a recent survey had some form of head injury playing middle school-aged soccer. It's an underreported or treated sector of the youth athlete population. Many of those girls continued to play even after their head injury and the presence of symptoms of concussion. I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines.
We're speaking today with Dr. Beverly Malone, Chief Executive Officer of the National League for Nursing, a membership organization for nurse faculty and leaders in nursing education. Dr. Malone was recently appointed to the advisory committee in the Office of Minority Health at the Department of Health and Human Services, which is dedicated to improving the health status of ethnic minorities and eliminating health disparities in this country. Dr. Malone also served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of Health at the Department of Health and Human Services under President Bill Clinton, also has served as Dean of the School of Nursing at North Carolina State University. Dr. Malone has served as President of the American Nurses Association, as well as General Secretary of the Royal College of Nursing in the United Kingdom, and serves on the Board of Trustees at the Kaiser Family Foundation. Dr. Malone, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare, and Happy New Year as well.
Thank you so much, and happy Martin Luther King Day.
Absolutely.
Birthday. Yeah,
thanks so much. And Barbara, it is that time of year where we really honor the legacy of Dr. King, and whose quest for equality often touched on the need to correct the lack of access to health care for all. And you were recently appointed to the advisory board of the Office of Minority Health at the DHHS. And tell us about the mission and the work underway at the office and to eradicate racial health disparities. And how are we doing on that front? And how do you see the Affordable Care Act as having an impact on the needs of all people?
Well, you know, one of the things that we do at the NLN is when we talk about diversity and inclusiveness, we spread it out in terms of not just racial and ethnic diversity, but all types of diversity and all types of inclusion. So that's the bigger picture, but I'll focus in on the representation and that we're still struggling. The whole, all the professions are still struggling with that. No one's got it right. And when I say right, I mean that the people who are providing the service look like the people who are receiving the service to some degree. And that's a goal, I believe, for all the professions. For nursing in particular, that's the one that I've given the majority of my time to. And while we, when we are compared to the other disciplines, we look fairly decent. But the truth is, we're still not there. We still don't have enough nurses representing those patients who are receiving the care. If you look at the data, it shows that about 13%, 14% of the population who are of the workforce is about African American in terms of nursing. But that's still a big leap in terms of how services are provided because the burden of illness is frequently on the underserved and the poor. And so that means that the people who are most dire in terms of needs of services, they are people frequently from ethnic and racial backgrounds.
So, Dr. Malone, this is an area that has gotten so much focus and attention, deservedly so, within the nursing profession, both on developing community-based health initiatives, which are fundamental to helping to improve the health of all people, but particularly underserved populations and minority populations. Maybe you could speak a little bit to some of these community-based health initiatives from your perspective that you think have the most promise, certainly progress with preparing our nurses in primary care and advanced practice. But what are those sort of optimum community-based health initiatives from your viewpoint that really help address these disparities?
Well, I think that my colleague, Dr. Mary Naylor from University of Pennsylvania, is doing a lot of creative work around that and has been for years. I mean, it's not like this is new. She's a trailblazer in terms of understanding that the transition is the issue and that transitions into the community, that most people want to be in their homes. They don't want to be in healthcare facilities. They don't want to be in hospitals. Hospitals should be just a pass-through, and Mary has been doing a lot of work around that, and her research is very valuable in showing how nurses work effectively to make those transitions, and when there's not enough physicians out there who are providing primary care services, that nurses are there to make sure that the needs of the patients are met. But we need more advanced practice nurses to do that. And so there's a whole piece around that's tied to having enough providers, even enough providers, period, advanced practice nurses, and getting the kind of funding from Congress to make sure that those providers are prepared, developed, and put into the community. Nurses tend to stay in the communities where they come from. That's sort of one of those nice statistics that if you really prepare nurses, they will not move away from their environments. I think probably because we're women to some degree, and our families and our roots are there, and so we tend to stay.
Well, let's delve a little deeper into the sort of the framing up of the challenges that nursing faces in this 21st century and sort of a burgeoning aging population. It's the opportunities that technology brings. There's the sort of more nurses, professionals fanning out into the communities they serve. So many pressures are being brought to bear on the nursing profession. So where do you see the biggest challenges lying ahead, and what kinds of new collaborations are being called out for to meet those growing demands? And are there some that you're particularly excited about?
Well, you know, the nice thing is I'm a baby boomer myself, and so I know that we are a different breed from the previous generation, and that we're going to be more demanding and expect more. And I think providers are going to have to be ready to provide more. And that's why I was talking about being in the home environment. Baby boomers are not going to settle for, oh, you can just stay in the hospital or a nursing home. No, no, we're going to want to be in our familiar settings. And we're going to be healthier, and it's going to take us longer to get ill. I mean, you know, so I think that it's a different population that we're dealing with. The challenge is the care of the older adult. How are we going to do that? Most providers don't go into the care of older adults. It's still something that's not a jazzy kind of thing that many providers want to do. So we've got this whole challenge about how to focus and make sure that nurses and other providers get into taking care of the older adult. Because when you do, you're basically taking care of all patients. I mean, if you look at the average patient, that person is frequently the older adult. So we're going to have to make sure that the faculty are prepared to teach the students that are coming through how to work effectively with older adults. Here at the National League for Nursing, we have seven centers, and one of our centers that we have is excellence in the care of older adults. And that one is about how we can help faculty be prepared to share information with students, get them turned on about working with the older adult. If faculty are not prepared, if they're not understanding how to teach those students, then it won't happen. And that's whether it's nursing or medicine or pharmacy. So we've got to indoctrinate the faculty. So that's one of them. The other thing is this thing about transitioning from nursing home into hospital and back to nursing home. It can be one of the most traumatic transitions around, that we know that older adults in nursing homes, that when they make that transition into a hospital setting, that frequently something goes wrong. So that if we can provide services and bring those services to whatever facility they're at, including their home, that we're already doing so much more in terms of stabilizing that older adult and making sure that they have as bright a future and time as possible and as active a time as possible.
We're speaking today with Dr. Beverly Malone, Chief Executive Officer of the National League for Nursing, a membership organization for nurse faculty and leaders in nursing education. Dr. Malone is on the advisory committee at the Office of Minority Health in the Department of Health and Human Services, which is dedicated to eliminating health disparities in this country. So, Beverly, you participated in the Institute of Medicine's groundbreaking 2010 report on the future of nursing. I had the pleasure of also working on the development of that, particularly from our perspective as having developed the country's first postgraduate residency training program for primary care nurse practitioners. And we just had the IOM's president, Dr. Harvey Feinberg, on our show talking about the follow-up to that report, Back to the Future of Nursing, in which he notes that progress is being made, but somewhat slowly. I think you have called the release of that report a watershed for the nursing profession. Tell us why that report is so vital to the path forward and how you and the NLN are helping to make sure that the recommendations contained within that report are being implemented.
Well, some of my colleagues might say, well, there's nothing different in the report that we didn't know. They're all issues that we have been working on for a long time, but we've never had a coordinated, scientific-based, evidence-based IOM report that says these are the issues, and we've got to do something about them. And they're basically like leadership is a major issue, that we find that nurses who have a very interesting perspective about patients. I mean, we're with them 24 hours a day, and so we know them in a very different way than other providers, that frequently, while we're listed as people who need to be on boards of healthcare organizations, we're not there. Somehow we don't end up there. That's one of the big issues in terms of leadership that the IOM report talked about. Another one was that we have at least three different ways to become a nurse, a diploma, associate degree, and baccalaureate degree. And there's not a stepping stone. There's not a good ladder between those to get to the baccalaureate degree. And so one of the things that the report says very clearly is there has to be that academic progression, and that we have to make it as easy and smooth as possible for that nurse who started out as an associate degree or a diploma nurse to move up into the baccalaureate or to the master's degree. And that academic progression is a huge issue, and there's work going on all around the country in making that happen. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation is very much involved in funding that kind of work. And then the third one had to do with there's just not enough data. We don't know what we need. And once again, it's not just a nursing issue. It's also an issue for the entire healthcare profession. How do we make sure that there's data and you can read it from one place to another? I think the government, they appointed a committee, an organization to do that work, but they never funded it. So we still don't have the data. Then every nurse should practice to his or her fullest scope that they have been prepared, whether it's the registered nurse or whether it's the nurse who is an advanced practice nurse practitioner out there providing services. We're not practicing to the full scope that we have been prepared to practice. And the report said very clearly that if we're going to meet the Affordable Care Act issues of another 30 million new people on the list, we're going to have more nurses prepared at that advanced practice level. And the thing that's different about the report is it brings all of nursing together, and it verifies that this was not a nursing-derived report, that it was others and the IOM, the Institute of Medicine, who said, these are the issues, this is what we have to do.
Dr. Malone, tell us a little bit about the National League for Nursing, which was founded 120 years ago. Tell us about the educational directives that you have going on and how people might be engaged with it.
Our mission statement is to promote the development of excellence and to build a strong and diverse nursing workforce to advance the nation's health. And I think you can hear in there all the things that we've talked about today, the faculty piece to promote and develop a strong and diverse, build a strong and diverse nursing workforce. The diversity issue is in there when we've been speaking about transitioning into the community, that it's not just good enough to prepare students. It has to be that it advances the health of this nation. So we feel very connected to what's going on in terms of the Affordable Care Act. Like you said, it's the oldest nursing organization in the country, and it's based on four core values of caring, integrity, diversity, and excellence. And the kind of programs that we have are leadership programs in terms of a leadership center, a transformational leadership center. We have a care of the older adult center. We have an innovation in simulation and technology, because so much of things changing is going to be around innovations in simulation and, of course, technology. We have a leadership center for diversity and global initiatives. Then we have one for the advancement of the science of nursing education. And that's the idea. If you need evidence-based nursing practice, and you do need evidence-based nursing education. Right now, so much of nursing education and maybe other types of education is sort of the way we were taught, we teach. And we've got to change that. We've got to move it to an evidence-based system. Just like the IOM report was evidence-based, nursing education needs to be evidence-based. And then there's the Center for Assessment and Evaluation and the Center for Academic and Clinical Transitions, which is about academic progressions, about how to move that associate degree or diploma nurse to his or her baccalaureate or master's degree, or how to move them from the baccalaureate degree to the doctoral degree. All of those are transitions, and all of those are academic progressions. So the league is involved in all types of programs that revolve around those seven centers. And we engage with, we have about 39,000 individual members, about 1,200 schools of nursing. All of them are very committed to seeing us rev up what we need to do to make sure that the programs that are preparing nurses are ones that actually move nurses to advance the nation's health.
Well, Dr. Malone, I really appreciate that strong emphasis and call for both innovation and evidence-based practice, certainly two drivers that underlie our community health center organization, which in turn is just supported by just an exemplary primary care and advanced practice nursing workforce. And as part of our innovations, we like to look globally around the world, look at best practices, see what we can learn, not just what we can teach. And I know that you've had a very global perspective through serving in the United Kingdom as the executive director of the Royal College of Nursing. You've twice been a delegate to the World Health Assembly, once appointed by President Clinton and then again by British Prime Minister Tony Blair. So you have a very global understanding of healthcare delivery issues and international nursing issues. Maybe you could share with us just a little bit, what did you learn from your work in the UK and these global experiences that you think is applicable to the work that you are trying to facilitate here in the United States?
You know, it was so interesting because one of the things my colleagues in the UK would ask me, who's best? I mean, who does it best? Or what's the difference between the U.S. and the U.K.? And it really depends on what piece you look at. Amazingly, the U.K. is ahead of us in some of the innovation that they're doing with nurses. Some nurses are performing surgery. And so I was a little awe-struck by that. But at the same time, there's no one who has a more well-developed, educationally promoted workforce than the U.S. I mean, the things we've been talking about today, the advanced practice, the leadership, those are really striking characteristics of the U.S. healthcare system. So I always think that it depends on which piece you look at. But the kinds of things that I learned had to do with that we're all more similar than we are different. And I guess that's not as profound as it could be, but it's the truth that I went there thinking, oh, it's going to be so incredibly different. And it was different. Language was different. There were other differences. But bottom line, patients are people. And providers like nurses and physicians, we provide services. So I think that's a pretty big learning thing for providers from the U.S. to understand that our colleagues, whether we're talking about the U.K. or whether we're talking about sub-Saharan Africa, that we are more similar than different. The other thing was that they have a very acute way of testing, whether it's medication or whether it's technology. There's a whole system of that that is used in the U.K., and that I don't think we have as clearly here. I know we have our FDA and other, but it just seems that their system is a little bit ahead of us in terms of making sure that whatever the product is, that it has been questioned and that it remains questioned and that everyone knows that there's a big question mark beside of it. The other thing I was fascinated with is the educational system is totally different for nurses than it is here, in that we produce a generalist who is either at the associate degree, the diploma, or the baccalaureate level. In the UK, they produce a specialist kind of, you know, the psychiatric mental health nurse, the obstetrical nurse, the pediatric nurse as the first graduation level. So that means they have a slightly like an army of providers who are pediatric nurses, an army of nurses who are psychiatric mental health nurses. And ours are usually not there until the graduate level. So there are pros and cons to that. But I have to say that I totally enjoyed working in collaboration with Tony Blair, because one of the big differences was that while Mr. Clinton, the president, was very attuned to nursing, his mom was a nurse, I never really sat down for 45 minutes and talked just about nursing with President Clinton. But twice a year, I would sit down with Prime Minister Blair and speak with him about where nursing was and what I thought could be done differently. So I thought that was a pretty big difference.
We've been speaking today with Dr. Beverly Malone, Chief Executive Officer of the National League for Nursing, a member of the Advisory Committee at the Office for Minority Health. You can learn more about her work by going to www.nln.org. Dr. Malone, thanks so much for taking the time sharing with us about the great work that you're doing on Conversations on Healthcare.
Delighted.
At Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
Well, readers have asked us if the Affordable Care Act allows states to confiscate the assets of seniors on Medicaid when they die. The answer is no, but a 1993 federal law does require states to recover Medicaid costs for long-term care from the estates of deceased Medicaid beneficiaries over the age of 55. The claims about the ACA have gone viral. One conservative website claimed that the Obama administration was, quote, turning the dead into cash cows. But the ACA did nothing to change existing federal law. What it did do was expand the number of people eligible for Medicaid so more could be subject to the old 1993 law. Here's the background on what's called the Medicaid Estate Recovery Program. Since Medicaid began in 1965, all states have been able to recover Medicaid costs spent on those 65 or older after those recipients died. In 1993, Congress passed a budget bill that required states to recover the cost of long-term care, such as nursing home care, for Medicaid recipients 55 and older after they died. In fact, the law gave states the option to recover all Medicaid expenses for such recipients. If the deceased recipient has a surviving spouse, minor child, or adult disabled child, the state can't recover any cost. There are also exemptions to allow family members to keep a family farm or home under certain circumstances. Because the ACA expands Medicaid eligibility, more people between the ages of 55 and 65 potentially will be subject to the Medicaid recovery program after they die. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare. Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. Primary care providers have their work cut out when seeing patient after patient all day long. In brief visits, it can be difficult to cover all of the important bases, and often signs of drug and alcohol dependence can get overlooked. And many patients are put off by lengthy questionnaires that are aimed at determining whether you have a problem with drinking or using drugs. Researchers at the Boston University School of Public Health have determined that asking one simple question could actually determine the level of a patient's possible drug or alcohol dependency. For alcohol use, participants were asked how many times in the past year they had consumed five or more drinks in a day. For other substance use, they're asked, how many times in the past year have you used an illegal drug or used a prescription medication for non-medical reasons? The researchers compare alcohol screening responses with alcohol dependence reference standards and drug screening questions with drug dependence standards. The single alcohol screening question detected 88% of those with alcohol dependence. The drug question detected 97% of those with drug dependence. Lead researcher Dr. Richard Sates says this could provide a valuable rapid assessment for primary care providers to help patients and get them to the treatment options they need. A single, simple question aimed at revealing drug or alcohol dependency that could help primary care providers diagnose the problem more readily, getting patients sooner to the help they need. Now that's a bright idea. This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from the campus of WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at wesufm.org and brought to you by the Community Health Center.